From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Larry Fishburne was the father in Boys in the Hood, but for years he played the kid. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to Larry Fishburne about co-starring in a soap opera when he was 10, and at 15, playing the young soldier in Martin Sheen's boat in Apocalypse Now. Fishburne stars in the new crime film, Deep Cover. And we remember one of America's most popular science fiction writers. Isaac Asimov died early this morning in New York at the age of 72. We'll hear an interview I recorded with him in 1987. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a political novel written by Michael Dukakis' campaign press secretary. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album of duets by Stan Getz and Kenny Barron. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The European Community's decision to recognize the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia has brought little comfort to people in the capital, Sarajevo, who continue to come under artillery and sniper fire, Pierre Vickery reports.
Political events in Bosnia-Herzegovina have moved with breathtaking speed. The Prime Minister has offered his resignation. A state of emergency and a night curfew have been imposed. Early general elections have been announced. And emergency talks are in progress between the Muslim state president and the Serbian commander of the Yugoslav garrison in the Republic. Dozens of people have been killed and wounded in 3 days of street fighting, and mortar and artillery shells are still falling on Sarajevo's medieval city center. Thousands of people remain inside the occupied Bosnian parliament building, and a group of Bosnian ex-communists have announced the formation of a government of national unity. The European Community decision to recognize Bosnian sovereignty has left many problems unresolved. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Shiite Muslim guerrillas killed 2 Israeli soldiers today in an ambush on an Israeli convoy in South Lebanon. The Israeli army said that its troops killed 3 guerrillas. In Lebanon, a spokesman for Hezbollah said that the attack was carried out by the group known as the Islamic Jihad in Palestine. Sources close to Israel's military say that Israel's top army commander in the north, General Yitzhak Mordecai, left the convoy by helicopter just moments before the attack. The attack took place just north of the Israeli border, in the area Israel calls its security zone. U.S. officials say Iraq violated Gulf War ceasefire agreements by launching aircraft on Sunday in an effort to combat an Iranian air raid on Iraqi territory. Any use of fixed-wing aircraft by Iraq is barred under the terms of the agreement that ended the Gulf War a year ago. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
At the State Department today, spokesman Richard Boucher expressed concern about the Iranian attack, and he urged both sides to observe Security Council Resolution 598, the agreement which effectively ended the Iran-Iraq War in 1988. And then Boucher added that this incident in no way affects Iraq's obligations to comply fully with all UN resolutions. That's a statement clearly intended to warn Iraq. But today Iraq said that it plans to use its air force to patrol the Iranian border area. Following the end of the war last year, U.S. aircraft shot down 2 Iraqi jets, which violated the fixed-wing flight ban. But despite today's warning, it's not clear how the U.S. would respond to an apparently defensive Iraqi air patrol. Sunday's Iranian attack was on a base used by anti-Iranian guerrillas about 60 miles from Baghdad. One of the Iranian planes, an American-made F-4, was shot down. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
This is NPR. General Motors made some changes in its top management today, moving the head of its international operations into the number 2 slot at the company. John Smith Jr. was named president and chief operating officer of the nation's biggest car company, which suffered record losses over the past year. Smith replaces Lloyd Royce as GM president and chairman of the company's North American Operations Strategy Board. He'll report to CEO Robert Stempel. Royce becomes executive vice president in charge of new vehicles and systems, where he'll be in charge of Saturn Corporation, electric vehicles, research, and other projects. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton turned his attention away from Jerry Brown for a time today, focusing instead on President George Bush on the eve of the New York primary. Eric Anderson of member station WAER reports.
More than 2,000 students and city residents turned out to hear the Arkansas governor on the Syracuse University campus today. Clinton chose to discard the sharp attacks on Jerry Brown that have marked the 2 weeks leading up to tomorrow's primary. Instead, he attacked the Republicans, who've controlled the White House for three terms.
I believe, as strongly as I can say to you, that for more than a decade, we have ignored our fundamental problems in Washington, and we need someone to run for president who will oppose brain-dead politics in both parties and give the American people a real plan for our future.
Clinton refused to predict how he'll fare with New York voters, but he did say he's confident about the outcome. For National Public Radio, I'm Eric Anderson in Syracuse, New York.
Isaac Asimov, the world's most prolific writer of science fiction, died today of heart and kidney failure in New York. He was 72 years old. Asimov wrote more than 450 books in his 50-year career, ranging from popularized science and history to his foundation science fiction trilogy. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Here's a question for everyone who saw Boys in the Hood, last summer's drama about gang violence in South Central L.A. Did you realize that Larry Fishburne, who played the father, also played Cowboy Curtis on Pee-wee's Playhouse? And did you remember Fishburne from his performance in Apocalypse Now as the young soldier in the boat with Martin Sheen? This young actor has had a long career. If you watch soap operas, you might even remember Fishburne from his role in One Life to Live when he was 10 years old. 2 years later, he co-starred in the movie Cornbread Earl and Me. Now he's starring in August Wilson's drama Two Trains Running, which opens on Broadway next week. And he's in a new crime film called Deep Cover. Fishburne plays a cop who goes undercover as a drug dealer in an attempt to penetrate a cocaine cartel. He hates drugs. His father was a junkie. But posing as a dealer comes so naturally, it frightens him.
I was supposed to be making a difference. Here I was selling drugs to kids and pregnant women. I hated doing what I was doing, but I was good at it. Being a cop was never this easy.
Your father, I believe, was a corrections officer, so I wonder if that affected your attitude toward cops when you were growing up.
Not so much my attitude towards cops as it was my attitude toward the possibility of winding up in jail.
Right.
I knew that that wasn't a place I wanted to go. My father would often come to me with messages from the young inmates that he was in charge of. And the one message that kept coming to me was that if I ever messed up and wound up in jail, that they would take care of me. So I knew that was a place I didn't want to go.
Did a lot of people assume after Boys in the Hood, in which you played the father, did a lot of people assume that you only wanted to play positive role models after that?
I'm sure a lot of people do think that. I think that there's a need for all that kind of stuff and positive role models and the like, but I have to do things for me. And, you know, we're all not positive role models, you know. And I think my responsibility is to reflect truth wherever I see it. And the truth is not always a positive role model, you know.
I think probably the most interesting roles are also probably not positive role models.
Yeah, you know, some of the most fun are not the role model guys. Absolutely.
A good example is your role in King of New York.
Which I'm very, very proud of.
Yeah, yeah. And you were, you know, big drug dealer in that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, he wasn't even a drug dealer. I mean,
just controlled vice.
Christopher Walken's character deals drugs. My character kills people.
Right, okay.
You know,
yeah,
and,
right.
And it's the kind of character you see in the movies all the time. For me, he's a classic two-gun kid. The role was written for a white actor, and we get to see white actors occasionally, or more than occasionally, often in movies, run around with two pistols, shooting people, laughing about it, having a good time, and going off scot-free. It's a classic movie type, and it's something I've always wanted to do. I had to campaign very hard to win that role, and I did, and I'm very proud of the work because, you know, I was able to do something that people, because of their color, aren't allowed to do. You know,
I usually hear the opposite complaint from African-American actors, that they have to that they're tired of being offered the roles of the killers, and you really right. went after this one.
Yeah, I wasn't even offered it. You see, that was the whole problem, you know. They offered me the cop that Wesley Snipes played in that movie, which would have been fun, but I think Jump was a lot more fun. And, you know, I there's a lot of young cats who see the movie who really enjoy it. Not just young people, but, you know, older people, too, who really enjoy the movie. So I'm really proud of that. I'm just as proud of that as I am of Furious.
The father mm-hmm. in
The father
in
Boys in the
Hood.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Larry Fishburne, and he stars in a new movie called Deep Cover. You started acting as a child. I think you had your first big role when you were 10. Did you want to act, or was it more your parents' suggestion?
I wanted to be a doctor. Right. And then I wanted to be a basketball player. But by that time, I was 9, and I got my first role professionally when I was 10. I had been doing, you know, plays in school and stuff, you know, from the age of 3, I guess. So the acting came to me naturally, as it does to most children, because children are the best actors. And from the age of 10, after getting my first job, it just kind of creeped along and built, you know, and kept building and building and building until, you know, here I am 20 years later.
How did you get, what kind of part did you have on One Life to Live, the soap opera, when you were 10?
I was a young orphan, kind of living by his wits on the street, who was found by this police officer breaking into his... into his office, and I subsequently got adopted by two black characters who had been romantically involved with one another on this show for many years, and we sort of became the first African-American family on television, or at least on a soap opera, daytime television, anyway.
That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you enjoy it? Did it feel like work or fun?
It felt like fun. I mean, I got to miss school 1 or 2 days out of the week. I got paid a little bit of money.
Did your parents let you keep the money that you earned?
No, that money was put away.
For your college?
Yeah, well, I never went to college, so, you know. But, yeah,
you went to Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
instead.
I went to Apocalypse Now school.
Right. We'll get to that a little bit later.
Sure.
When you started acting as a kid, was your mother with you, or, you know, behind you when you were getting roles
sure.
as a kid?
Sure, she was very much behind me. She was very supportive. In fact, you might even say she was a bit pushy at times.
What would she do when she was pushy?
Well, she would. The pushy stuff was like there'd be auditions for, you know, for musicals and stuff like that, you know, and for really, really commercial kind of things. And even at a very young age, I was not interested in doing very, very commercial things. You know? Not very interested in doing the thing that was going to be popular just based on the material itself. You know? So those kind of things I would resist a lot.
But she'd try to push you into doing them?
Yeah, she'd try and push me into them, and I'd be like, no, I don't think so. I'm not going to do that.
Any big hits that you talked your way out of?
Let's see now. Well, there was a play that was called The Me Nobody Knows.
Oh, I remember that.
That I was like, nah, I don't think I want to do that. Yeah. You know, a few things. I can't remember.
When you were 12, you starred in Cornbread Earl and Me,
right,
which I never saw. I don't even know what it's about, to tell you the truth.
Oh, it's a great little movie.
After making Cornbread Earl and Me, were you a celebrity in your neighborhood?
I guess I was. Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, people used to call me movie star a lot. And they'd say, hey, movie star, how come you dress like a bum?
Were you kind of a bohemian when you were young?
Yeah, I've been a bohemian all my life. John Singleton really, really hit it on the head. John was like, people are like this and that. And John looks at me and goes, Fish is a hippie, man. He's a hippie.
Did people in the neighborhood think you should be wearing your money?
Yeah. Yeah, especially the kids.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Larry Fishburne, and he stars in a new movie called Deep Cover. You'll also know him as the father in Boys in the Hood, And he, at the age of 15, was in Apocalypse Now. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor Larry Fishburne is my guest. The movie Apocalypse Now broke the hearts and souls of grown men who were in it. You were 15 when you were cast in that film. You were you were like the kid in the boat taking Martin Sheen down the river. Your mother came with you to the Philippines to shoot the movie, right? How did your father feel? I mean, I'm sure you were expecting to be there for a few months. The movie took, I think, more than 2 years to
make. Yeah, we were told we were going to be there for 3 months. And we wound up staying the better part of 2 years, 76 and 77.
So the family was divided for that period of time.
Well, you know, the family really, the family unit was my mother and myself. My mother and my father were, you know, divorced when I was very young. So I pretty much grew up with my mother. My father did, though, come over and spend a great deal of time with me, and it was actually for the first time in my life that my father and I lived together was when I was over there, and that was really nice. It was very, very, very nice. So we were actually kind of together rather than that we were divided towards the end of the shooting. I think the last 6 months of the shooting, my father was there with my mother and I, and my mother's new husband, because she had remarried. So,
how did it feel? Here you were working with Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper and Robert Duvall, and you're there with your mom, you know? Did you feel like, Mom, go home?
No, I mean, you know, my mother was a teacher and is a very creative person herself. So she really let me go. I mean, to a large extent. I mean, in that environment, she recognized that her son was now, you know, 6 inches taller than her and was involved in this, you know, pretty serious undertaking. So she didn't try and restrain me in any way. She really let me go.
I'm sure there were a lot of, I imagine that there were a lot of drugs on the set, a lot of marijuana and maybe LSD. So when your father was down there, him being a, you know, corrections officer, a law enforcement guy, did he turn his head the other way?
Well, no, he didn't. He didn't, not at all. In fact, that was the reason that he came down.
Oh.
Because,
to keep you straight?
Yeah, really, to keep me straight. Because my mother, like I said, she let me go and she couldn't get me back. So she called in the big guns.
So what did he do?
He followed me around everywhere I went, and he carried a big stick. You think I'm kidding?
He really did carry a stick?
He really did.
Did he use it on you?
No. My father's psychological. Psychological. My father's a very big man. He's very big.
Well, did he use that kind of psychological stuff on Dennis Hopper?
No, he didn't have to. He wasn't there for Dennis Hopper. He was there for me.
Uh-huh.
So it worked.
It did?
It worked.
Yeah. Were you afraid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was it like to be 15 years old and working with actors like Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper, who seem to have kind of flipped, you know? I saw the movie Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now, and as extraordinary Brando and Hopper are as actors, they seemed like they were so difficult to work with. And so here you were watching these, like, two great actors behaving bizarrely.
Yeah, yeah, it was very interesting. Fortunately for me, my character is dead by the time we get to see those two guys. So I didn't have to work with them in that way. But as far as behavior, I had never seen anybody behaved the way Dennis Hopper did. And I think we all know that no one behaves the way that Brando does other than Brando. So it was very interesting. And it was, I mean, I was very impressionable, 14, 15. I had never heard of Dennis Hopper. But when I saw him, I had never seen a human being behave that way, and I was like, this is the guy. This is the cat. Forget about Brando. Forget about Sheen. This is the man. I want to be like this man. Because he was just out, you know? He was in a continual state of chaos. He was just amazing to watch. And those were not his best days.
Right.
But in order for him to get where he is, he had to go through that. So, you know, I was very impressed. The whole experience, because I was so young, you see, to me, all of that was normal. It was only my second film. So I came back from that experience thinking, okay, well, this is the way you make movies. You have too much money, you have too much time, and you go completely crazy while you do it.
So how did you change when you tried to model yourself on Dennis Hopper?
Oh, well, you know, I tried to drink as much as I can and smoke as much reefer as I can and listen to as much loud music as I can, that kind of stuff.
Your father must have been thrilled.
He was. He was. Well, see, that's why he had to carry a big stick.
Right. So what got you out of that period?
I came home. I came home, and I had to go to high school. You know, I had to, like, finish high school, you know?
God, going to high school after making Apocalypse Now, that must have been
something.
It was
a joke. It really was. It was quite funny. But Francis was, you know, Francis was cool. He understood what he had done, you know.
What was the most, I'm sorry, go ahead.
He understood where he had kind of dropped me and what kind of environment he had dropped me in. So I went to go stay with him. He opened a school for gifted youngsters. Actually, the school he called, he said, for kids who want to rule the world. And it was me and his son, and Giancarlo, who has passed away in 86. God bless him. And Mickey Hart's son and some other kids. So we ran around, and we were like assistants to all these other people who were doing great things. You know, like I was Wim Wenders' assistant for a while, which meant I went and got the pizza and the cigars and cleaned up after they had, you know, readings and stuff.
So that's the high school you went to, or did you go to real high school after?
Well, I went to real high school after that, but you know, sort of in between going to real high school and graduating, I went to go to this kid, you know, to the school for kids who want to rule the world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Larry Fishburne, and he stars in a new movie called Deep Cover. Now, you were a regular on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
You betcha.
You were cow. There you go. You were Cowboy Curtis.
Yes, ma'am. Ooh-wee.
And you had a great animated lasso.
Yes. Magic lasso.
Yeah. How'd you get the part with Pee-wee?
I met Pee-wee in L.A. Back in the early 80s. And he and I became friends, and I was doing Gardens of Stone, and I got this call. He said, I need a black cowboy. So I said, no problem, you know, and I saddled up and rode on in. Kind of where it's at.
Was it fun to work on the show?
It was wonderful.
I really love that show.
I mean, it was the first, you know, television show for children that had live people on it for a long time.
Now, you've made two movies with Spike Lee.
Made one with him.
One movie? Mm-hmm. Why am I thinking it's two? It was School Days. What was I thinking of the second?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Was it Do the Right Thing?
No, I know you're not in that.
Mm-hmm.
You were asked to be in that.
I was asked to play Radio Raheem.
But you turned it down.
Right.
How come?
I didn't like the part.
Yeah, tell me what you didn't like about it.
Well, I didn't like the script. I grew up in Brooklyn, too. And Radio Raheem, to me, wasn't well-developed as a character. He wasn't defined on the page. And that meant that I had to bring all the stuff to make him human to it. And I felt like I had done enough of that in terms of what I did in School Days for the character of Dap. The problem that I have with Spike's work is that he doesn't do as much rewriting as he could. And he leaves it to the actors to sort of fill in the blanks, which is nice. It's nice to have that kind of freedom. But at the same time, if you're allowed that kind of freedom and the director won't let you in on what his vision is, it's kind of difficult to know what to do. Spike has a ceiling that you can't see about how far he'll let you go. He welcomes your input and he welcomes your improvisation, but to a point. So it's difficult to know how far to go because he won't tell you how far you can go. And when things are well-defined on the page, then you know how far to go. With Do the Right Thing, we got a script that I think was about 98 to 109 pages with a character who had no dialogue, who was basically a device to create this big race riot scene at the end. And I'm not really kind of into race riots. I don't think they help anybody, so I passed.
Could you work with Spike Lee after turning down one of his roles?
Could I work with him?
Could you work with him again after that?
That's up to him.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to?
If the material was really good and, if it was something I was interested in doing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you worked with John Singleton on Boys in the Hood.
Right.
I understand he was a production assistant on Pee-wee's Playhouse, and that's
you
how you met?
You
betcha. It's Cowboy Curtis again.
Yeah.
That was the first script he wrote. Was that well fleshed out?
Very well. It's airtight, watertight. He wrote it in school, in this dramatic writing program. He won an award for it. He went back and wrote it again, re-entered it in the same contest and won the same award again 2 years in a row. He had thought about it for 4 years before he wrote it.
Was there anything about Furious, the father that you played in Boys in the Hood, that reminded you of your own father?
not until I saw the movie a couple of times did I see my father in my performance.
Uh-huh. What was it in your performance that reminded you of him?
There's just a look. There's a way that I hold my face in one particular scene that I went, oh, there's my dad,
Is your mother really pleased with the way your career has turned out? I think of all the child actors I've seen on Entertainment Tonight and all those shows talking mm-hmm. about how they have to be in self-help groups because their lives were so troubled and tragic mm-hmm. after the TV series stopped or whatever.
Right,
and
right.
You've gone on to a real serious, interesting, fine career.
Well, that was the other thing that my mother wanted me to do was be in a series, and that was the thing that I resisted.
Huh.
And I think it's because of that resistance that I've been able to survive and have a career as an adult.
Right.
So I hope my mother is pleased.
Larry Fishburne, thanks a lot for talking with us.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Larry Fishburne stars in the new film Deep Cover. Next week he opens on Broadway in August Wilson's play Two Trains Running. This is Fresh Air.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember one of America's most popular and most prolific science fiction writers. Isaac Asimov died this morning at the age of 72. We'll feature an interview with Asimov from 1987, in which we discuss the state of science fiction when he started writing in the 30s and how his laws of robotics changed the genre. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Candidate's Wife, a political novel written by the press secretary for the Michael Dukakis presidential campaign. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album of duets by Kenny Barron and the late Stan Getz. It's billed as Getz's last recording session. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The 12-member European community today granted formal diplomatic recognition to the breakaway Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
European foreign ministers meeting in Luxembourg today made their decision to recognize the ethnically mixed republic despite reports of new violence in the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo. Nearly 100 people have died in the republic in the past week in clashes that pit ethnic Muslims and Croats, who favor independence, against ethnic Serbs who wish to remain in the Yugoslav Federation. Bosnia becomes the third former Yugoslav republic to win recognition by the EC. Croatia and Slovenia were granted that status earlier this year. The ministers delayed a decision on granting recognition to Macedonia. Greece has vehemently opposed such a move, fearing an independent Macedonia would one day make territorial claims on the neighboring Greek province of the same name. Of the six republics that until January made up Yugoslavia, only Serbia and Montenegro have indicated a desire to remain part of the federation. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
Armored vehicles patrolled the capital of Peru today after President Alberto Fujimori seized control of the government. Late last night, Fujimori announced he was suspending the Constitution and dissolving the Congress and the judiciary. He says lawmakers have not done enough to solve Peru's economic problems, leftist insurgencies, and cocaine trafficking. Fujimori put congressional leaders under house arrest and imposed local press censorship. Opposition legislators say Fujimori is establishing a dictatorship. The military is supporting him, but a retired police major says the police force is not. The U.S. has budgeted nearly $300 million in aid for Peru this year, but the White House says that plan is now under review. The slugfest between the Democratic presidential candidates continued today in New York as Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown attacked each other on racial issues. Paul Rosenthal of member station WAMC reports on the eve of the New York primary.
Jerry Brown continued to jab at Bill Clinton today for playing golf at all-white clubs. Clinton fired back, claiming Brown once suggested white kids teach black kids how to read and black kids could teach white kids how to fight. The racial issue is just one of many being raised as the two candidates make a final plea for votes tomorrow. At a rally on the state capitol steps in Albany, Brown toned down his shots at Clinton and made a pledge that would make commuters happy.
And I will promise you, before the decade is out, I will move people from one end of Manhattan to Long Island in 20 minutes on a clean, American-built transportation system.
Brown said the race is very close, but a recent statewide poll shows that while Clinton is losing ground, Brown is not gaining any. Clinton still leads with 37% to Brown's 26. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Rosenthal in Albany, New York.
Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials gaining 26 points to close at 3275.49. This is National Public Radio. Two Israeli soldiers were killed and five others wounded in South Lebanon today when pro-Iranian Arab guerrillas attacked an Israeli convoy. Three guerrillas also were reported killed. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The Islamic Jihad movement in Palestine claimed responsibility for the attack, which occurred less than 1 mile from the Israeli border in the area Israel calls its security zone. A group of Arab attackers ambushed the convoy with machine gun and rocket fire as it drove through a village. According to Lebanese security sources, one of the Israeli officers in the convoy was Northern Commander Yitzhak Mordechai, but he was not hurt. The Israeli army would not confirm or deny the report. Israeli troops returned fire, killing three guerrillas. In a statement in Beirut, the group said the attack was to avenge the killing of Hezbollah leader Sheikh Abbas Mousawi, who Israel assassinated in February. Israeli gunners retaliated by shelling three villages in South Lebanon. Israeli security forces say that radical Islam is spreading, and they are concerned about more possible attacks on Israeli soldiers. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
General Motors has appointed a new number two manager. John Smith Jr. is moving up to president and chief operating officer. He has been directing GM's international operations. He replaces Lloyd Royce, who becomes executive vice president in charge of new vehicles and systems. Defense attorneys today asked a court to let the jury see an animated tape representing the beating of Rodney King by Los Angeles police officers. The defense has hired a biomechanical engineer who applies engineering principles to the human body to analyze injuries. The engineer has created computerized videotapes intended to show how hard one of the officers struck King. The prosecution has asked that the judge keep the tapes out, maintaining they don't meet standards of the scientific community. Caterpillar says about 300 of its workers have crossed picket lines after being threatened with the loss of their jobs. You're listening to NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Let's think about the race for First Lady. There won't be one if Jerry Brown wins the Democratic presidential nomination, but if Bill Clinton is the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton and Barbara Bush will be campaigning on drastically different First Lady platforms. Barbara's a traditionalist. Hillary's a reformer. Maureen Corrigan has just finished a novel about political spouses called The Candidate's Wife by Patricia O'Brien. Maureen says this novel makes it clear that any woman who actually wants to be First Lady ought to be disqualified on the grounds of insanity.
Here's a Washington insider story for you. An old student of mine works in a posh Georgetown jewelry store. One day, a very stylish older woman came in and bought some silver bracelets. She paid for the bracelets by check, and when my old student asked for some ID, this woman drew herself up stiffly and announced, "I'm Mrs. Lloyd Benson." Well, lots of political wives fall into this Mrs. category. Mrs. Pat Buchanan, what is her first name anyway? And Barbara Bush. Even though we know her first name, she's also struck a deal to stand by her man in return for basking in his reflected glory. The other kind of political wife, Rosalind Carter, Nancy Reagan, is the one who tries to assert herself. She's always labeled a hungry power freak. It's fascinating right now to watch Hillary Clinton try to navigate between these two traditional political wife images and make an independent role for herself. So far, she's not doing too good. She's offended Tammy Wynette and the career cookie bakers. And the latest rumor is that she's been angling for a position in her husband's cabinet. If Hillary doesn't start effacing herself soon, Barbara Bush will squash her with that same coy phrase she used to describe Geraldine Ferraro in the 1988 election. It's a word that rhymes with witch and begins with a B. Meow, meow. Hillary should take a break, kick back, and read Patricia O'Brien's novel, The Candidate's Wife. O'Brien would console her with the rueful truth that even if a candidate wins by a landslide, his wife will always find herself in a no-win position. The candidate's wife is a thumping good political potboiler. O'Brien's story focuses on Kate Goodspeed, loyal wife of Democratic and Catholic presidential candidate Luke Goodspeed. With a name like that, how can he lose? Well, maybe by having an affair with his beautiful deputy campaign manager. Then there's the little issue of abortion. Kate is pro-choice. Luke manages to remain neutral until Kate blunders into a public fight about abortion with a Catholic cardinal. Throw in the Goodspeed's pregnant teenage daughter and their suicidal chief campaign aide, and you've got big election problems, bigger than, say, not inhaling a joint. O'Brien served as press secretary for part of Michael Dukakis' disastrous presidential campaign, so she writes with intimate knowledge about how the Goodspeeds' lives become nothing more than a series of media moments, and how their political compromises threaten to destroy their identities. She's also insightful about the payoff Kate gets for playing the role of Mrs. Candidate for President. "It's a thrill," Kate tells her sister. "When I hear the applause after Luke talks, and I know we built the ideas together, I feel the applause is for me, too." Sure it is. Kate learns painfully that she can't go on living with her ego transplanted into the body of another person, and she becomes a more outspoken kind of candidate's wife. But let's face it, nothing's really going to change until we have a few novels entitled The Candidate's Husband.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Candidate's Wife by Patricia O'Brien. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. This morning we lost one of our most popular and most prolific science fiction writers. Isaac Asimov died of heart and kidney failure at the age of 72. He had cut back on his writing earlier this year after a prostate operation. When Asimov started writing science fiction in the 1930s, he didn't expect that fantasies like space travel and nuclear power would be realities in his lifetime. Throughout his life, he kept looking ahead, projecting what life might be like in the future. Asimov leaves us with over 350 books of science fiction and science fact. He emigrated with his parents to America from the Soviet Union in 1923 when he was 3 years old. The family settled in Brooklyn, New York. As a child, he loved reading science fiction magazines. His first story was published in the magazine Amazing Stories in 1939, 1 week after Asimov's 19th birthday. I spoke with Isaac Asimov in 1987 and asked him what those early science fiction magazines were like.
Those early magazines were larger than the science fiction magazines of nowadays. Some were actually the size of the Slicks, the Sat Evening Post, things like that. Usually they're made of cheap paper with rough edges. They paid a half cent a word to a cent a word. And the only way you could possibly make a living out of this pulp fiction was to write a great deal and quickly and without undue revision. And I learned how to do that in those days. I thought that was the way to write. I didn't know any better. And I've kept that up ever since. And so as a result, I now have published 366 books, and I'm making a good living out of it.
Now, you coined the term robotics in a story that I think you wrote in 1942.
That's right. The story was called Runaround. And I had someone refer to the three laws of robotics, and that was in fact, I think they called them three rules the first time I mentioned them. But that was the first time the word robotics was ever used in print in the English language, and I get the credit for it in the Oxford English Dictionary.
That must be a thrill.
Yeah. Two other words also I get the credit for.
Oh, really? Which ones?
One is psychohistory, which I was the first to use in my Foundation series, and the other is positronic, which I was the first to use in connection with my robots.
Would you review the three rules of robotics that you came up with?
Well, I eventually called them three laws. Number one is a robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law is a robot must obey orders given it by a human being, except where that would conflict with the first law. And the third is a robot must protect its own existence, except where that would conflict with the first or second laws.
Now, these were rules for robot designers?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, they're taken seriously. In other words, a great many of the early people who worked in robotics were more or less inspired by my robot stories, and they knew the three laws, and they realized that if they could develop robots that obeyed them, that would be great. So far, the robots we have are still extremely simple computerized levers. They're not complex enough to have the three laws built into them.
What were the robots that you envisioned in the 1940s when you were writing this story?
Well, they were typical robots that we used in science fiction. They were made of metal, and they had a roughly humanoid shape. My contribution was that they were designed with safeguards. That's what the three laws were. Until my robots came in, mostly what robot stories consisted of was robots being built and then destroying their creators. It was the Frankenstein story told over and over and over and over again. And I took the attitude that robots would be machines, and that one of the chief concerns of those who built them was to make it impossible for them to do harm. That apparently struck everyone as sensible, because after my stories became popular, the old-fashioned robot stories disappeared, and the new kinds of robot stories, even when they didn't quote my laws, which, of course, they didn't like to because they were mine, they simply assumed they existed, and so did the readers.
You know, for years you've really been writing more science than you have science fiction. How come?
Oh, well, until 1958, I wrote mostly science fiction. But then when Sputnik went up and everyone in the United States got scared that we were falling behind in science, I felt it was absolutely necessary for anyone who knew science and could write to try his hand at educating the American public. So I deliberately stopped writing science fiction, mostly, and started writing science books. And that went on for 21 years, and then Doubleday got tired. And they said they wanted me to go back to writing science fiction novels. And they were very persuasive. And so I wrote Foundation's Edge, which was a continuation of the old Foundation series that I'd written 30 years earlier. And it hit the bestseller list, stayed on for 25 weeks. To my intense surprise, it was my 262nd book. And until then, I thought I had a perfect score, you know, that I knew exactly how to miss the bestseller list. I'd done it 261 times in a row, and flopping on the 262nd surprised me. But after that, Doubleday wouldn't be stopped. They wanted a novel every year, and I've been writing them, and they've been doing very well, I'm glad to say, because they're hard to do.
You know, your book, Fantastic Voyage, reminded me in a way of an essay that you wrote a few years ago about a triple heart bypass that you had. And in that essay, you described having an angiogram, which is where they basically inject dye into an artery so that they could monitor the flow of blood through the heart. And you had the option of watching the angiogram on the video screen that your heart was being monitored on, but you wrote that you turned your head and you didn't want to watch it.
No, I didn't.
For the author of Fantastic Voyage, describing all these scientists journeying through the body's bloodstream, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, it's like that old statement saying that the management is not responsible for the views expressed in this program. Well, I'm the management, and I'm not responsible for the views presented in my stories. I travel all over the galaxy. In real life, I hate to travel, and I never go in airplanes. When I wrote a book called The Human Body, I described every conceivable disease and bad working that I could think of without a shudder. But in real life, I'm very queasy.
Well, now we could get to your fear of planes. For someone who wrote about a spacewalk before astronauts actually landed on the moon, yet you were afraid to fly planes. That's quite a paradox.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm afraid to fly them. I just
don't trust
never
them.
Got into the habit of it, that's all. And now it's too late. I just don't want to. But that's part of a bigger problem. I just hate to travel by any means. I like to stay where I am. I never leave Manhattan voluntarily. And I don't know why that is. When I'm forced to travel, it doesn't bother me very much. It's just that I happen to like it at home.
You once wrote that we should not see science or technology as inevitable destroyers or saviors. Does that kind of sum up your view of technology?
That's right. It's technology is neutral. That is, it depends on how it's used. It's up to us to use it wisely or foolishly. And often our intentness on immediate gain, on short-term goals, causes us to use it foolishly without due regard for the long-term harm we might do. And that's sad, of course, but on the other hand, it's understandable. It's very difficult for human beings to take the long view and to give up the immediate profit.
With that said, are there any breakthroughs or inventions that you really would like to see happen?
all I want to see, I want to have people find out just how the brain works. And that, to me, is the most important conceivable problem to be solved in the world. And on a lesser scale, I would like to see a space-centered society. I want to see the human range extended. I want to see mining stations on the moon and huge settlements in orbit around the Earth. I would like to see power plants in orbit and factories. I would like to see as much as possible of Earth's industrial plant moved into space so that we don't foul our own nest with waste products. Of course, people say, well, then we'll just foul space. But space is much larger, and space has an automatic cleaning device called the solar wind, so that things might be better up there. Oddly enough, the pollution of space is not so much the ordinary chemical wastes and all that. It's the fragments of satellites that are beginning to worry people, because they stay in orbit. Billions and countless billions of little particles, sometimes just of paint, which are moving around at 5 miles a second, and which, when they strike, can do damage, even when they're very light. So we're going to have to figure out ways of sweeping up space, for instance.
If there were space colonies in your lifetime, would you dare to travel to them?
No, not me. Not me, but someone has to stay on Earth, and I volunteer.
Isaac Asimov died this morning at the age of 72. Our interview was recorded in 1987. Asimov's latest book was published this month, called Isaac Asimov's Complete Stories, Volume 2. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, are you covering New York on this day before the big primary?
You bet. Linda Wertheimer will review the state of play in the New York primary, talking with NPR's Mara Liasson and Elizabeth Arnold. Andy Bowers reports on attack advertising in New York, especially the radio advertising campaigns. Ina Jaffe reports from California, an analysis of Jerry Brown's record in office. Also, we'll talk with Arthur C. Clarke in Sri Lanka about Isaac Asimov, the writer who's died at age 72. Clarke tells this story. Isaac Asimov left the theater when he was seeing for the first time 2001, written by Arthur C. Clarke, because he said that Clarke violated his, Asimov's, laws of robotics.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tenor saxophonist Stan Getz died of cancer last June at the age of 64. 3 months earlier, he made what's now being billed as his last recording, a set of live duets with pianist Kenny Barron, just released on the album People Time. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Some jazz fans and critics get ghoulish about a great artist's last recordings. They'd rather listen to a record where Billie Holiday sounds like she's dying than one where she's in great voice and skips across the beat. These fans may be disappointed by how healthy Stan Getz sounds on People Time, a live album with pianist Kenny Barron. Getz's style is as gracefully romantic as ever, without anything undignified like self-pity. There are a few moments where he sounds a little winded, but he can still knock you off balance with a twist of a phrase. The mature Stan Getz was an uncommonly consistent and resourceful improviser with a sumptuous tone on tenor sax. When Getz came along in the 40s, everybody said he copied Lester Young, and everybody was right. But Getz developed an instantly recognizable sound of his own early in his career. Some musicians sound like they love their instrument, some like they love themselves. Stan Getz sounded like he loved music. ¶¶ For much of his working life, Getz had a reputation for being a tough boss. Musicians who toured with him or even auditioned for him tell colorful horror stories about his antics. But reports from recent sidemen suggest Getz mellowed a lot in the last few years. That makes me wonder if his music finally subdued his personal demons. How could even a tough guy be exposed to that sound every night and not be affected by it? In an ideal world, the release of this album would focus lots of attention on Getz's full partner here, Kenny Barron. The pianist has a lot of the same virtues as Getz. He's inventive, he has great taste, and he pays close attention to the sound he gets from his instrument. Lately, I keep reading about jazz pianists who are hyped as being able to play every style. Kenny Barron is one of the very few who can actually do that. Kenny Barron isn't the most famous jazz piano player, but he does record a lot. Other recent albums of his I really like are a solo CD in Concord Records' Maybeck Hall series, one with his trio for the Candid label titled Lemuria Seascape, and one with bassist Red Mitchell's trio, Talking, on the Capri label. But I like Barron's final meeting with Stan Getz the most, partly because these two really listen to each other. The only jazz fans who won't like People Time are ones who think a good record has to have a banjo.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. He reviewed People Time, featuring Stan Getz and Kenny Barron, distributed by Verve. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurek directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Debates over a failing economy, possible sex scandals, controversies over press partisanship. Sounds like the American presidential primaries, but it's also the story of the British elections, which are coming up this Thursday. On the next Fresh Air, a talk about the British elections and how they're being covered with New York Times London correspondent William Schmidt. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.